Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
You probably know that Australia had a term on the Security Council of the United Nations recently, and in fact got to chair it for six months, which was very exciting for people who are interested in international relations. But you might not know that Australia was not only a founding member of the UN, but played a prominent role in the negotiation of the Charter back in 1945, right after World War II. And this was particularly thanks to High Court Judge and Attorney General in the Curtin and Chifley governments, H.V. Evatt, or Doc Evatt as he was commonly known. We were also one of eight countries involved in drafting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The UN turned 71 this year, and tonight we want to look at the organisation's role on the global stage, from international peacekeeping to protecting human rights, and also getting involved in bringing war criminals to justice. So how effective is the modern UN? Well, there have been some difficult times as well. The Iraq Oil for Food program became a scandal in the mid-1990s, and of course some of the efforts in the 1990s in places like Rwanda and Sierra Leone, some of them worked out, Rwanda not so much. Sierra Leone, however, did. They've also been involved in protecting heritage sites, places like the Galapagos Islands. And our relationship with the UN has gone through a few ups and downs since the early great involvement of Australia. And I think Doc Evatt was the third president of the General Assembly as well. In 2015, Tony Abbott, our Prime Minister at the time, said Australians are sick of being lectured to by the United Nations after a report found that our treatment of asylum seekers breached an international anti-torture convention. But Julie Bishop, the Foreign Minister, has just announced that Australia plans to bid for another seat on the UN Security Council in 2029 to 2030. Now, radio programs like this talk about the UN from time to time, but we're going to get a bit of a different perspective tonight with people who've actually been very, very active on the ground and at headquarters in New York. Leanne Smith is an Australian diplomat and human rights lawyer. She's on sabbatical in Sydney at the moment, but her normal job is as Chief of the Policy and Best Practice Service of the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations in New York. Leanne, good evening.
Good evening, Dom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Are you having a bit of a break from all this and you've come in to talk to us?
Yeah,
all the same.
It's lovely to be here. It's great to be back in Sydney too.
We also have with us Leslie Pruitt, who's a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University in Melbourne. And she's got a book called Women in Blue Helmets, Gender Policing and the UN's First All-Female Peacekeeping Unit. And she's in our Melbourne studio. Leslie, good evening.
Good evening, Dom.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
When did the UN's first all-female peacekeeping unit go out and put on the blue helmets?
They first deployed in January of 2007. It was originally meant to be a six-month deployment, but it was seen as so successful that they extended it to 1 year, and then they started a rotation and replaced them every year up until this year. They went home on the 14th of February, so they had nine rotations in total.
And where was that unit based?
They were based in Liberia, so the women were from India's Central Reserve Police Force. They were recruited from across that and deployed again year after year.
Okay, very, very interesting. So we'll talk about that and how that worked as part of the broader peacekeeping mission and perhaps explore some of why it was so successful. But let's start with you, Leslie, in terms of how this actually works in practice, what the UN is intended to do. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I think you've covered a lot of that in terms of the history and the intentions of the UN about, you know, creating an avenue for states to come together to discuss key problems in the world and what the solutions to them might be. So avenues for peacekeeping, peace building and diplomacy. It's the Security Council is often seen as particularly important in terms of giving legitimacy or denying legitimacy in some cases for the use of force in different international situations.
And Leanne, what's your perspective on this, the original charter? How relevant is it still today to our world?
I think it's a really good point. And because of everything that's going on in the world today, I think where those of us working for the UN are drawn back to the founding principles of the organisation. So I'm sure a lot of your readers haven't picked up a copy of the charter very recently.
It's been a while. We should have it framed on the wall here, but we don't, I'm afraid to say. Can you remind us what it says?
Yeah, I do carry it around a little bit. So,
excellent.
Yeah, maybe just to remind people about what Article 1 of the Charter says about the purposes and principles of the UN, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but the first principle is to maintain international peace and security, including the prevention and removal of threats to the peace. The second is to develop friendly relations among nations based on respect for the principles of equal rights and self-determination. The third is to achieve international cooperation in solving international problems of an economic, social, cultural or humanitarian character, and in promoting and encouraging respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms. And then lastly, and this one plays on my mind a lot these days in terms of what's happening in the world, is quite simply to be a centre for harmonising the actions of nations in the attainment of these common goals.
Harmonisation, yes, it's a term that the EU's taken up in recent years as well, but the UN was, the original place where that was being attempted. So that's a fairly extraordinary goal to take on in 1945, isn't it, or to begin drafting at that point, where the world is really just recovering from the Holocaust and all the other atrocities of World War II. I'm amazed somehow that they found that note of positivity and optimism, and in particular that there was an idea that all nations would be equals at the UN. It wasn't simply going to be the victors doing their thing, as even though that might have been brought out in the Security Council.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe you referenced the earlier attempts to build something like the United Nations with the League of Nations. I mean, this was a world coming out of two successive world wars, and I think maybe the lessons of both of those experiences were enough for the victors to realise that the same stuff wasn't going to work again.
Yeah, and I think Germany had lingering resentment, didn't it, from the way that the League of Nations played out. So I guess that's a lofty goal. How does this work in practice? And we'll get on to what Leslie goes and does and some of your experiences in a moment. But Leanne, as someone who currently works there in New York City at that extraordinary headquarters there on the river, what do you do? What's your job?
In terms of my work?
Yeah, yeah.
I think I have one of the most interesting jobs in peacekeeping, at least, maybe in the UN as well. I have the privileged position of being able to work with all 16 of our peacekeeping missions around the world, and trying to learn lessons from what's going on the ground in these different contexts and to feed those lessons back into all of the politics and bureaucracy of headquarters to try and engage in policy reform, guidance, training, debate in a way that moves forward the agenda. So focusing on that, the headquarters and the field perspective at the same time.
But how interesting, because I imagine that they're in the... surrounds of New York City, you can feel a bit isolated from what's going on in the field. But if you're talking to each mission on the ground, you're the link.
Yeah, it's great because I support teams in all of our missions working on some of the thematic mandates that the Security Council gives to the peacekeeping missions. So that includes protection of civilians, women, peace and security, conflict-related sexual violence, HIV/AIDS, and a really interesting function we do in peacekeeping missions that not a lot of people know about, which is the work of our civil affairs officers. So working with them and getting to visit them and bringing them into the headquarters is a great way of calling out what's not working and supporting what is working.
What do the civil affairs officers do while we're in passing?
Yeah, sure. Well, if you go to South Sudan or another country where there's a peacekeeping mission and you go out into the sticks and you see a UN civilian, more than likely there'll be a civil affairs officer. So they're our people at the real grassroots community level, and their job is to represent the whole of the UN to that community, to help extend the state authority from the capital down to the local level, and to play a role in local reconciliation and early warning.
Okay, so really the people embedded in the communities with a big, big job. So that's what Leanne does. Leslie, can you tell us a bit about what you've done and how you fit into this picture of peacekeeping operations and some of the things the UN does?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. So my most recent project, as you mentioned, has been about particularly about gender mainstreaming in peacekeeping, and especially about the involvement of women in peacekeeping, which has been on the radar of the UN for quite some while. Women have participated for many years in UN peacekeeping, but in terms of military and police peacekeepers, still in quite small numbers. The numbers change from month to month depending on who's deployed where, but tend to sort of sit between 1% and 3% of military peacekeepers are women, and around 7 to 10% of police peacekeepers are women. In 2009, the UN police started the global effort, and they made this big goal to reach the number of 20% of women police by 2014. But unfortunately, we're still only at about half that. But there have been some really, I think, innovative initiatives to work towards that over that time. And the one of those that I've looked most closely at has been the creation of all-female foreign police units. And I've looked especially in depth at the first one of those deployed from India. So for that, I did interviews in New York at the Department of Peacekeeping Operations and India at the Indian Police Service and Central Reserve Police Force and with other officials there. And then also at the United Nations Mission in Liberia, where they were deployed while they were still there. At that time, we actually had, I think he's still there, in fact, the Australian leading up the police in that mission, Greg Hines.
What an interesting thing. So that particularly, I guess, given that in quite a few countries in the world, the role of women as police officers and soldiers is still somewhat contested. That must be a really interesting thing in terms of social change, both in the places where they serve, but perhaps also back home in places like India. I wonder how much female police presence there is on the streets.
Absolutely. Actually, India has been historically quite a leader in women's policing in that sense, because they had the first in the world women's police stations, which were started in the 1970s by Indira Gandhi in the state of Kerala. And then those have developed. There's over 500 around India now. They then developed in the Central Reserve Police Force further police units that these women are deployed to Liberia from. So there's been this that emerged from sort of women's activism in India, with women claiming their rights and saying we want access to police that serve our needs, and we feel that women can better meet those needs in many cases. And that's resulted in women attending these all-women police stations. It's also had big impacts in Liberia, where they've been deployed. So within a few months of the all-female peacekeeping unit arriving in Liberia, the numbers of women applying to join the Liberian National Police tripled. So just by having this sort of visible presence and this idea that women could be police and them to be there and be training in that context really had a significant impact both, you know, at home and in Liberia.
Yeah, it sounds like it does. And Leanne, I guess that's another interesting factor of what the UN does. It brings ideas potentially that work in one place to another place. And from what you've been saying, you're involved in trying to learn lessons and pass them on.
We are. And I think, you know, I've come across some really interesting experiences myself working in Liberia and East Timor, where we've seen individuals from one country that's been hosting a peacekeeping operation, them advising the governments or civil society of another country. So I've been in Liberia where East Timorese experts on finance and budget have been advising Liberian government officials, both on how to recover from crisis, but also on how to have a relationship with UN and UN peacekeeping.
And we might actually just ask, where else is the UN active? We've talked about Afghanistan and Liberia, but you mentioned, Leanne, that there are 16 missions happening at the moment, so it's certainly a lot going on. You're possibly even quite stretched.
We are more stretched than we ever have been, certainly. In terms of the missions, I think we have something like 120,000 individuals deployed. The great number of those, about 100,000, are uniformed officers, but there are a lot of civilians in what we call multidimensional peacekeeping operations these days. So we're not just, back in the old days, monitoring a blue line or a green line. We're engaged in a whole lot of what I would call peace-building activities, whether that's supporting justice institutions after a conflict or supporting elections, doing human rights monitoring, as you mentioned earlier, disarming armed groups. The missions are engaged in a hell of a lot more. Even interestingly, I think, as with one of our most recent missions, the one in Mali, the UN has been mandated by the Security Council to get involved in protecting cultural heritage, which is a very new area and one that shows how expanded the mandates that the Security Council gives peacekeeping are these days.
Yeah, I can imagine some of the lessons from a place like Afghanistan might have been brought in there. So I guess it's getting more complicated than simply, let's just keep these two groups apart. You're actually trying to create a lasting peace once the UN moves out. And so where else is the UN active at the moment? I mean, we won't go through the whole list, but just a couple of missions that are on at the moment.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the bulk of them are in Africa, unfortunately for Africa these days. So long-standing missions in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo. I was also part of setting up the newish mission in South Sudan not so long ago. The most recent missions in Africa have been in Central African Republic and in Mali. But the most recent mission, which is kind of completely out of left field in a way, has been the mission that's been sent to support the, whether it exists or not, the peace agreement in Colombia. So that's a very different kind of mission to the ones we've been working on recently.
Yeah, we just heard last night that referendum to implement the peace deal was narrowly lost by something like 50.24%, so certainly plenty to be done there. Yep. Let's talk about how the process of peacekeeping works. And if you want to join our conversation, by the way, the number is 1-300-800-222. You can text 0467-922-702 as well. We've got some texts actually from someone who's been involved in a UN deployment previously, so we'll get to that question or point a little bit later on. But from your perspective, Leslie, what's the general mechanism for this stuff happening? And I'm asking you, I guess, as an academic rather than someone who works for the UN at the moment. What's the process, as you see it, in terms of how the UN decides what to do?
In terms of peacekeeping?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess most commonly is that the state itself is requesting for the UN to be there and be involved in that. So usually the UN's not typically going into a state without that state wanting them to be there. In most cases, that's the way that, you know, the state is in inviting the UN in the sense they're saying, we need help from the UN. Can you support us in this sort of situation?
Okay, so that's a precondition. But then is there what pattern have you discerned in terms of where the UN goes in, if any?
Oh, in terms of where the UN goes in, I think it's just where there's the most need, I suppose. As Leanne said, they're spread quite thin in this way because there's so many things going on in the world. And, you know, it has to be agreed by the Security Council again, so that you've got some limitations around that at times. And in terms of having the permanent five members having vetoes on things like that, so there may be a case where a lot of countries or states believe that there should be some intervention done, but if one of those five members says no, they can veto it. There is possibility to sort of circumvent that through UN General Assembly uniting for peace resolutions, but that's not too commonly approached.
Leslie Pruitt's with us in our Melbourne studio. She's a senior lecturer from Monash University and looking at peacekeeping, and in particular all-female peacekeeping units that we've been talking about. And Leanne Smith works within the UN headquarters in New York on peacekeeping operations. Leanne, what's your perspective on this? I guess that it's interesting to me that it's the Security Council that signs off on this stuff rather than the General Assembly, and also that the state has to consent, by the sounds of things, to peacekeepers arriving.
Yeah, this is a unique feature of UN peacekeeping is the consent principle. Maybe for your listeners, just to outline, UN peacekeeping operates under three principles. The first is consent, and that's technically consent of both parties, or the parties to the conflict, not just the host government. The second principle is that of impartiality, in that the peacekeeping mission is required to implement the mandate fairly and equally between all actors in that country context. And the third is that peacekeepers should not use force except in self-defence or in defence of the mandate. Given that most of our mandates these days require us to protect civilians, then the link is made between peacekeeping missions being able or authorised to use force in order to protect civilians.
And the UN has had to go into quite a few difficult situations previously. There have been many successes of UN peacekeeping. There have been some things that didn't work quite so well. I'm interested to know, I guess, Rwanda and Bosnia are topics that come up when we're talking about this. We'll talk about some of the successes as well. Leanne, what was learnt by these missions that I guess were perceived not to have worked entirely as intended? Perhaps you feel that they did. When UN peacekeeping doesn't work, what's the problem? I'm sure there are many problems, but I mean, this is the thing. If only this sort of stuff worked all the time, but it's often very complicated.
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges to making things work. I think if you look at the missions, the devastating outcomes of the missions in Bosnia and Rwanda, what we've learnt from that is what we now call protection of civilians. So that whole body of responsibility, all of those mandates come from a recognition that the peacekeeping missions weren't able to, didn't choose to defend civilians when they could have saved lives. So much of the work that we do now is trying to figure out how to do that better. Complicating factors in how you do that in a country the size of Democratic Republic of Congo or South Sudan. There's a huge challenge when the Security Council gives us a mandate like that, you shall protect civilians. It sounds so important and so grand. And trying to match that with the geographic space of these countries, the resources that we're given to do peacekeeping, how long it takes to deploy troops, the kind of assets we have. There's just no comparison with, for example, what the Australian military has as it's at its fingertips. So,
yeah.
The challenges are multitude, not least of them, those principles I talked about before. If you as a UN peacekeeper are required to protect civilians from all aggressors, in some cases that can include armed forces of the state government. If the UN acts against armed forces of the government, then questions about the quality of the consent of that host government for the peacekeeping mission do come up, and we find this tension between implementing the mandate as it's given and needing to have the consent of the host government to do the job properly. And I think if listeners are interested in any particular scenario, you can look at what's happening in Darfur and what has been happening in Darfur for a long time to show how that can hamper mandate implementation.
Yeah, and look, I guess as well, as with any situation like this, whether it's under UN auspices or not, when you've got people from a potentially unrelated country coming in and performing peacekeeping, there's a very, very high bar for the safety of those troops, and there probably should be. But if you're asking peacekeepers to go in and protect civilians who might be being attacked, I imagine the stomach for casualties and all the kind of stuff is not very much at all. If someone's sending soldiers in as essentially humanitarian action, if things go bad, how much willingness is there to keep with a mission when things turn sour?
I mean, if you think about how we're operating in places like Mali at the moment or Central African Republic, it's also complicated by the fact that the rise of non-state armed groups and how they operate in and around communities sometimes makes it very hard to differentiate between an aggressor and a civilian as well. So, speaking very personally, and I am speaking personally tonight, if I was faced with that very confronting situation, knowing whether to pull the trigger or not, if that was the ultimate thing you had to do, would be a very challenging one.
I can only imagine. Leslie, anything to add to this discussion about how peacekeeping works on the ground when it perhaps doesn't, and the great challenge, I guess, of going into a potentially unfamiliar country and inserting yourself into a conflict?
Yeah, I think indeed there's definitely lots of challenges. Leanne's covered a lot of those. I guess one thing to point out to the listeners, if maybe they're not aware of that, is the sort of the way that peacekeeping works in terms of we talk about peacekeeping is international peacekeeping typically, but the troops, the military or police, tend to remain under the state direction, you know, the command of their own country. So that's obviously a challenge in how you sort of negotiate and have agreements when you have people under different command structures within the same operation area. So it's always, you know, something that requires ongoing good communication and diplomacy to make sure everyone's on the same page and can work together in that sense.
The text here that I was referring to before says, as a veteran of a UN deployment to Rwanda, you may wish to ask your guests if they can ever foresee a time when the UN will get a little tougher when peacekeeping. They certainly need to, says this person. And Leanne, I guess that ties into what you were talking about in terms of protection of civilians.
Yeah, it does. And it's that tension that we see between wanting peacekeepers to use more force when it's appropriate, but by our very doctrine, not supposedly using force to do the job of peacekeeping. I think this points to one of the things that I wanted to mention about the challenges the UN is facing as a whole, but peacekeeping certainly. The reality of the situations we're being put into these days don't really fit always with the doctrine or the principles or the structures that we have in place.
Yeah, and it's really interesting too. I know I don't want to trivialise the situation, but it just keeps reminding me of a Star Trek episode. You're going into an unfamiliar place. You don't want to hurt people. You don't want to destroy the culture. And there are all kinds of ethical dilemmas. Perhaps people would understand this better if they looked at what the Enterprise do. But it does seem to be very, very hard because you don't want to do too much, you don't want to do too little. And, of course, if the UN gets it wrong, then support gets lost in the international community. Mm-hmm. Troops may be withdrawn, and then the next time peacekeepers are needed and you make the pitch to the country to invite you in, maybe they'll say no. So there are a lot of factors at play here.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, peacekeepers are being sent in by the Security Council to protect and support the individuals living in those countries, not just the governments of the day. So the layer of diplomacy that we have to work with in the UN is obviously from that, you know, government to government level. But one of the key elements that the High-Level Panel on Peace Operations drew out, which if people aren't aware of it, was a massive independent study and report that came out in 2015. One of the big things it said about peacekeeping was that we really need to get better at being a more open interface with the populations we are there to serve. It's very easy to deal with the political elites in a capital who speak English and who we can understand better, but it's really, like the work of those civil affairs officers, it's about getting down to the grassroots level and getting down to the root causes of the problems. If we don't get to that level, then we're never going to be able to walk away.
So it does sound as though the UN is certainly trying to learn from previous problems. And look, there is a fundamental instinct, I guess, that so many of us have, to want someone to do something in difficult situations. And sometimes we look at the superpowers and hope that their overwhelming force can be brought to bear and punish a bully. And occasionally, we turn to the UN and hope that their moral legitimacy will have an impact. It's often harder than that in practice. Maria's going to ask a question about a situation that I think is in many of our thoughts. Hello, Maria.
Hey, how you going, guys? Thanks for this topic. It's really timely. And I was just thinking about the UN maybe half an hour ago, and it's in relation to Syria. And really, I understand it's a complex issue, but all the stuff on Facebook of those children and everyone getting on, mothers, families going, can't stand seeing it, and everyone feels completely and utterly helpless. And so I wondered just where the UN is on all of that.
Mm. Let's go to you first, Leanne, and we'll go to Leslie in a moment.
Thanks, Maria, for the question. And like a lot of other people, I feel your frustration too. The UN is in Syria. Some of my friends and colleagues are on the ground trying to be able to distribute humanitarian aid there. I think what you're referring to, though, quite rightly, is the higher level political problem about why we can't reach agreement through the UN about how to deal with Syria. And this obviously goes to questions around how the Security Council is structured, the role of the permanent five members of the council and their ability to have vetoes over any vote, and the fact that you basically have two of the world's superpowers on different sides of the conflict here, which means that in this conflict scenario, the way the UN is structured currently, it's hard to see how it can be effective at that high-level political level.
Maria, are you still there?
Yes, I am. I was just tuned in. Yeah, I just, like many of your listeners, I would imagine they see that stuff on Facebook and just, wonder why more isn't happening and how they can do anything about it.
It's a real human instinct, isn't it? Thank you very much for the call, Maria.
Thank you. Bye.
Our number is 1-300-800-222. Sorry, Leanne, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add something more on Maria's point, which is not about what the UN can do in Syria, but why peacekeeping isn't the short-term or long-term solution right now. And that is that one of the principles of peacekeeping is that we can't send in peacekeepers unless there is a peace to keep, which points to the question of politics being at the centre of ending conflict and there needing to be an agreement that all sides to the conflict have bought into and are willing to stand by. If you don't have that in place, then peacekeeping isn't the solution.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of another really interesting situation that was conducted under the auspices of the UN and I think still is today, which is, of course, the Korean situation, that border there. And the South Korean response, I believe, is conducted under the UN's auspices. So that, again, that's just very difficult, the difference between how things work on the ground and the principle by which these things were set up. I'm keen to get your response, Leslie, on that question of Syria and what the UN can and can't do in situations like that, when so many of us would love a solution to be brought in.
Yeah, thank you, Dom. I mean, I can really understand what this woman's saying, and you hear this every day, that people are really finding this, frankly, a heartbreaking situation, and it's all across the news. It's in everyone's lives now, and seeing this as a major issue. And it's the biggest conflict-related movement of people that's happened since the Second World War. So sometimes we think, oh, things just look worse because now we get more news. But actually, this is really, really significant, large-scale event, and it's having impacts all over. And it's as Leanne was saying, it's a lot of this is so much a question of political questions as well, of how these things will be navigated. And we see that recently in Europe with many of the debates that are going on around migration of peoples there, with debates within and without outside the EU. And it's a quite a tough road ahead, I think, but absolutely it's going to take a lot of people working hard and working together to get some humane outcomes in this situation.
Yeah, and look, there are lots of places where we wish the UN or someone could do something. Keith's texted in to say, what is the UN doing in West Papua now? And I know that lots of Australians feel very strongly about that situation, and I guess that touches on what a state asks you to do, perhaps, Leanne.
Yeah, and it touches on the fundamental structure of the UN system and goes back to the point I was making earlier that one of the challenges the UN faces now is that post-World War II compact that it's built on is very different. And one of those principles, I guess, that it was built on is that the nation state is the sole international actor. Now, we know that's not the case anymore. We're looking at international corporations, civil society organisations, international organised crime, terrorist groups, the range of actors that the UN system needs to work with or work around or work towards is much, much broader than it was. And for now, this is Indonesia in this case, right?
Yeah, so Benny Wender and his friends in West Papua, as meritorious as their cause may be, they're not recognised as a state actor at this point, so they don't really get a seat at the UN table. It's really interesting, too, to think about the Security Council and, I mean, Australia's brief participation on that council, but that is an organisation which really does reflect the victors in World War II. And at the time, I'm sure that was the realpolitik of the way 1945 in national relations looked. But now, I mean, particularly Germany and Japan have been arguing for many years they should get a seat at the table, that 1945 order shouldn't continue. But it seems as though, you know, the Security Council has no interest in reforming itself. And I wonder, I might go to you on this, Leslie, what could make a change occur? I mean, why would anyone give up a veto and broaden things out unless they had to?
Well, that's a good question. Up until now, I guess the answer has been they wouldn't. I can't, predict the future to say what will happen about that going forward, but I mean, it's going to depend on how the UN continues to be shaped and evolve in the future. In some ways, you know, the UN is now coming up on 71 years old. And of course, in many ways, it's going to have to adapt to a changing world and to a new generation. But it's really going to remain to be seen how that's going to be done. You know, as I mentioned before, sometimes with limitations of getting agreement in the Security Council, there's other avenues that can be done, you know, through the General Assembly, for example. Perhaps those will be taken up more often in the future. It's really difficult to say because things are changing every day in that sense.
Yeah, just to look at one example, I mean, France obviously was not in a particularly strong position after World War II, but was put on the Security Council. But they're now locked in the European Union with Germany. So when they exercise their vote, are they voting on behalf of the EU? Are they voting on behalf of France? Germany is probably fairly resentful of France's relative influence in that sense. That must be a pretty awkward situation, Leanne, just in terms of looking at how far we've come. And in a sense, the EU is a peacekeeping organisation within Europe, and it's worked very well in one sense. But we've moved so far from that post-1945 order.
I think about this a lot too. And I think this comes back to the question of what is the UN? We talk about, I feel like the tone of conversation when we talk about the UN in Australia is very much the UN over there, that body, that structure. The UN represents the collective will of its member states. So it's our UN. It's all of every nation's UN, right? So the idea that the Security Council needs to represent the collective is a really important part of it. Now, for me, there are very few incentives to give up a veto power or to give up that power by any of the P5 members. There are lots of academics, lots of practitioners working towards tweaking the edges of the Security Council working methods to try and make it more inclusive. But to be very frank with you, I think it's going to take something as serious as a challenge to the legitimacy of the UN as a whole for any one individual member of the council to want to give up that power. I don't know if you know the artist Norman Rockwell, but he did some really interesting work in the 1950s at the height of the Cold War, the Korean War, looking at the UN. And he has a wonderful painting called it's not even a painting, it didn't make it that far. It's a drawing called the UN Drawing. This amazing image of Security Council members sitting at a table with 65 individuals representing countries from all around the world looking over their shoulder. And for me, that's a really important image and a reminder of the responsibility on the shoulders of the Security Council.
And it's certainly true that great powers do often want to have a good reputation. Let's have a chat to Lee, who's called up. Hello there, Lee.
Hello, good evening. How are you this evening?
I'm very well. Look, thank you for joining us. We've got Leslie Pruitt and Leanne Smith here talking about the UN. You've got some experience in this area too.
Yeah, I've served as a peace enforcer, not a peacekeeper. Look, it was in Timor-Leste, and I guess my experience has come from a couple of perspectives. Is one, you know, your rules of engagement or what you can and can't do in regards to using force or removing threats from civilian populations. And I guess the other one, the key sort of thing, is the level of difference in training between multinational forces that you will operate in on these types of operations. So I guess the first one, as a peace enforcer, you've got very different rules of engagement to what the UN may give you to look after civilian populations.
Sounds that way, Lee, even from the term.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, in my experience as a peace enforcer, you certainly had a bit broader of a range to disarm threats to civilian populations or take action if there was threats against them. You know, and you may do that, but then later on in that day, you could see those same people walking around the communities. They may not have a weapon on them, but you still know that they pose a threat. And it's a very difficult thing to deal with and grasp with as a peacekeeper or a peace enforcer.
I'm keen to get our guests for you on this. And just to reiterate, Leanne, can you remind me, I think there was an international force in East Timor, but then the UN took over once the peace had been established to some degree. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And the UN has been there and back again. The first UN mission departed, thinking that peace had been maintained and that everything was looking all right. But tensions between two different branches of the security forces in East Timor reignited, if you like. And then we had a second peacekeeping operation going in. UNMIT was the last mission, and it only departed a couple of years ago. We learnt a lot from the Timor experience. That's particularly about UN transitions and how we as peacekeepers need to be planning with the whole UN system, with civil society, with other countries in the region, about what the lifespan of a UN peacekeeping mission should look like and how we should responsibly disengage from a country so that the work we're doing in whatever area it is, rule of law or disarmament or whatever, is responsibly handed over to other partners so that the peace is sustained and not cut short.
Is it helpful then in situations like Timor to have that different model, and it's not one that the UN endorses or is able to endorse, but the INTERFET type mission where you've got an expanded remit, the sort of thing Lee was talking about, is that a transferable model or is that particularly possible because of the particular circumstances in Timor?
Yeah, I think all of our peacekeeping missions are very context specific in terms of what's happening on the ground, but also in terms of neighbours to that country in terms of regional arrangements. But the kind of the flexible models of how we deploy peacekeeping operations is also one of the key recommendations of this high-level panel report from 2015. We see a lot of partnership in peacekeeping now in Africa, for example. So several of the international interventions have started out as either bilateral interventions or AU interventions or sometimes sub-regional interventions in Africa. And then once some of that fighting has been done or that peace enforcement has been done, then a transfer or what we call a rehatting to a peacekeeping mission. So there is a recognition that there's no one-size-fits-all template.
Lee, there you go. Thank you very much for that.
No worries.
Great to get your perspective as someone who's served on the ground there. And Leslie, do you want to add to that in terms of experiences like that? And are you taking a look at what works in a range of contexts in your studies?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the important things that Lee was pointing out was the differences in training, and that occurs both within and between states. So different states may have different levels or different types of training for different missions they deploy in, but also within a state that can be the case. I've recently been doing some interviews on a project about deployed women from Australia from a variety of contexts, and I could hear just from doing those that it ranged a great deal about what training people received and how much they received. And it's important to, think about our assumptions in terms of what training people get as well. One thing that stood out to me when I was doing my research on the first all-female peacekeeping unit was that there were all these statements from various actors saying that it's important to have women in peacekeeping because they're needed to deal with sexual and gender-based violence, which is a big issue in peacekeeping. And in many ways, I think that's absolutely true and that is important. But sort of an underlying assumption of that was that women sort of inherently, naturally know how to address victims of these sorts of crimes. And what I found when I was interviewing the first commander of the all-female unit is she said to me, you know, we got there on the ground and folks are saying, okay, great, now address sexual and gender-based violence. And she said, we're riot police. You know, this is not actually our training. So she said, I had to go out and make sure that my officers were properly trained in this and had to seek out that training. And so we're still needing to move towards, I think, that being an across-the-board training that people get. Lisa Carson, a PhD student I've worked with at Melbourne Uni, has done some research on that and looked at sort of training around gender in UN deployments from Australia. So there's still more to be learned and more to be done on that, I think.
Interesting that the assumption was that women would not necessarily be riot police but be trained in the other stuff, and perhaps a bit of a sexist assumption there. Any comments on that, Leanne?
Yeah, also an assumption that it's no one else's responsibility.
Yes.
On the training question, it's a really challenging one when you have troops deployed from, I think it's 123 countries, personnel from 123 countries. It's a huge challenge. Someone else also mentioned command and control and how difficult that is. What the approach the UN is taking, a UN peacekeeping is taking, is formulating training standards across every mandated function of a peacekeeping mission, including women, peace and security issues. But all we can do at this point is give those training standards to the national training institutes of all of those contributing countries, and we don't have visibility on how they're used or how effective the training is.
It certainly sounds as though the UN is trying to learn and iterate in what it does, but what it does is very complicated. We won't take Ken's call, but I'm going to ask the question that he was going to ask just because we've only got a few moments left. Ken wanted to know whether the UN has actually managed to prevent war or not. And I started this discussion by saying, look, this was the original thought that we needed to try and prevent conflicts like World War II. Now, we haven't had World War III, which I think is in itself a success. But I wonder if there are some examples you can point to, Leanne, where the UN has done what it was intended to do, stopped conflict or perhaps either from happening in the first place or ending a situation that was a problem. When's it actually worked out?
It's like a false
how do
positive.
You define right? success, yeah.
If it didn't happen, who gets the credit for it not happening?
I think the UN can claim World War III. I think it's perfectly reasonable, to be perfectly honest.
So far,
yeah, fingers crossed.
Look, I don't have an example that comes to mind of how we've prevented, but I do know that there's been a hell of a lot of research on the effectiveness of UN peacekeeping And it seems to be, you know, pretty well agreed, the evidence that peacekeeping missions are effective in maintaining peace and reducing the risk of a return to conflict. That's probably the best we can say, that the studies have shown where peacekeepers have gone in compared to countries where peacekeepers have not gone in, the recurrence of violence is much less in those cases where we're present. It's not to say that we're not getting a lot wrong, and we don't have a lot to learn from what we're getting wrong, but effectiveness of UN peacekeeping, given what it costs. I don't know if your listeners would be aware that the annual budget of peacekeeping, UN peacekeeping this year, is just under $8 billion. Sounds like a lot of money. 120,000 people in across 16 countries. It equates to 0.5% of global military spending. So
it's a lot less than we spent on the conflict in Iraq, it occurs to me, particularly the US.
So it's still the least expensive option for, you know, member states who would prefer not to go in bilaterally or regionally or in any other way.
Yeah, look, a lot of it's very important work indeed. Might get some last thoughts from you, Leslie, on all of this, when the UN's done what it was meant to do.
Yeah, well, I think as Leanne said, you know, the best outcome is we don't see anything happening. So that's always the difficult thing to document. But I think we can give credit on a lot of the work that's being done. I think, as we've discussed, the UN's clearly not perfect. It clearly has its problems and its challenges, but it also clearly has its place. I would say it's a necessary and critical venue for states to be able to come together to discuss shared problems, to create solutions and to work together in visions of a peaceful future.
Leslie, thank you so much for your insight this evening.
Thank you.
Leslie Pruitt from Monash University. She's a senior lecturer in politics and international relations, and her book is called Women in Blue Helmets, Gender Policing and the UN's First All-Female Peacekeeping Unit. And Leanne, thank you so much for your time as well on your sabbatical to come in and talk about what you do.
Thank you very much for having me.
Leanne Smith, who is on sabbatical from a role as Chief of the Policy and Best Practice Service of the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations based in New York.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.